She said, "Thank you, but aren't you afraid I might take the first plane to the Bahamas? There's still a lot of work to be done." "I think I can trust you." There wasn't a trace of irony in his voice, but there really didn't need to be. He said, "Speaking of trust, I think your phone may be bugged. I'm sorry. I should have told you that sooner." Maria stared at him. "How did you know?" "No. You mean it is? You've had definite signs?" "I'm not sure, but how..." "Mine is bugged, so it makes sense that yours would be too." Maria was bewildered. What was he going to do? Announce that the fraud squad were watching him? If he came right out and said it, she didn't think she could dissemble any longer. She'd have to confess that she already knew, and then she'd have to tell him everything Hayden had said, taking the pressure off completely, ending the farce for good. She had no talent for these stupid games. The sooner they could both stop lying to each other, the better. She said, "And who exactly do you think is doing it?" Durham paused to think it over, as if he hadn't seriously considered the question before. "Some corporate espionage unit? Some national security organization? There's really no way of telling. I know very little about the intelligence community. Your guess would be as good as mine."
"Then why do you think they're..."
Durham said blithely, "If I was developing a computer, say 30 orders of magnitude more powerful than any processor cluster in existence, don't you think people like that might take an interest?" Maria almost choked.
"Ah, yes.
But of course I'm not, and eventually they'll convince themselves of that and leave us both alone, so there's absolutely nothing to worry about."
"Right."
Durham grinned at her. "Presumably, they think that just because I've commissioned an Autoverse planet, there's a chance that I might possess the means to actually run it. They've searched this place a couple of times. I don't know what they expected to find. A little black box sitting in a corner of one of the rooms, hidden under a pot plant, quietly cracking military codes, raking in a fortune on the stock market, and simulating a universe or two on the side just to keep from getting bored. Any 5-year-old could tell them how ludicrous that is. Maybe they think I've found a way to shrink individual processors to the size of an atom. That would just about do it." So much for an end to the lying. He wasn't going to make this easy for her. "All right." Maria forced the words out evenly.
"And any 5-year-old could tell you that if anyone searched your flat, it was the fraud squad."
Durham was still giving nothing away. "Why do you say that?"
"Because I know they're watching you. They've spoken to me. They've told me exactly what you're doing."
Maria faced him squarely now. She was tense at the prospect of a confrontation, but she had nothing to be ashamed of. He was the one who'd set out to deceive her from the start. He said, "Don't you think the fraud squad would need to get a warrant and search the flat in my presence?"
"Then maybe it hasn't been searched at all. That's not the point."
He nodded slightly, as if conceding some minor breach of etiquette. "No, it's not. You want to know why I lied to you?" Maria said,
"I know why. Please don't treat me like an idiot."
Her bitterness surprised her. She'd had to conceal it for so long.
"I was hardly going to agree to be your accomplice."
Durham raised one hand from the tabletop, a half-conciliatory, half-impatient gesture. Maria fell silent, more from astonishment at how calmly he seemed to be taking all this than any desire to give him a chance to defend himself. He said, "I lied because I didn't know if you'd believe the truth or not, and I think you might have, but I couldn't be sure, and I couldn't risk it. I'm sorry."
"Of course I would have believed the truth. It would have made a lot more sense than the bullshit you fed me. But yes, I can see why you couldn't risk it."
Durham still showed no sign of contrition. "Do you know what it is that I'm offering my backers, the ones who've been funding your work?"
"A sanctuary, a privately owned computer somewhere."
"That's almost true, depending on what you take those words to mean." Maria laughed cynically.
Oh, yes? Which words do you have trouble with? Privately owned?
No. Computer. And somewhere.
Now you're just being childish.
She reached out and picked up her notepad, slid her chair back, and rose to her feet. Trying to think of a parting shot, it struck her that the most frustrating thing was that the bastard had paid her. He'd lied to her. He'd made her an accomplice, but he hadn't actually swindled her. Durham looked up at her calmly. He said, I've committed no crime. My backers know exactly what they're paying for. The fraud squad, like the intelligence agencies, are jumping to absurd conclusions. I told them the whole truth. They've chosen not to believe me. Maria stood by the table, one hand on the back of the chair.
They said you refused to discuss the matter.
Well, that's a lie. Although what I had to say certainly wasn't what they wanted to hear.
What did you have to say?
Durham gave her a searching look. If I try to explain, will you listen? Will you sit down and listen to the end?
I might.
Because if you don't want to hear the whole story, you might as well leave right now. Not every copy took me up on the offer, but the only ones who went to the police were the ones who refused to hear me out. Maria said, exasperated,
What do you care what I think now? You've extracted all the Autoverse technobabble from me you could possibly need, and I know nothing more about your scam than the police do. They'll have no reason to ask me to testify against you, if all I can say in court is, Detective Hayden told me this, Detective Hayden told me that. So why don't you quit while you're ahead?
Durham said simply, Because you don't understand anything, and I owe you an explanation. Maria looked towards the door, but she didn't take her hand off the back of the chair. The work had been an end in itself, but she was still curious to know precisely what Durham had intended to do with the fruits of her labor. She said,
How was I going to spend the afternoon anyway? Modeling the survival of Autobacterium hydrophila in sea spray?
She sat.
Go ahead. I'm listening.
Durham said, Almost 6 years ago, loosely speaking, a man I know made a copy of himself. When the copy woke up, it panicked and tried to bail out. But the original had sabotaged the software. Bailing out was impossible.
That's illegal.
I know.
So who was this man?
His name was Paul Durham.
You? You were the original?
Oh, no. I was the copy. Chapter 16. Toy Man, Picture It, June 2045. Paul felt a hand gripping his forearm. He tried to shake it off, but his arm barely moved, and a terrible aching started up in his shoulder. He opened his eyes, then closed them again in pain. He tried again. On the fifth or sixth attempt, he managed to see a face through washed-out brightness and tears. Elizabeth. She raised a cup to his lips. He took a sip, spluttered and choked, but then managed to force some of the thin, sweet liquid down. She said,
You're going to be fine. Just take it easy.
Why are you here? He coughed, shook his head, wished he hadn't. He was touched, but confused. Why had his original lied, claiming that she wanted to shut him down, when in fact she was sympathetic enough to go through the arduous process of visiting him? He was lying on something like a dentist's couch, in an unfamiliar room. He was in a hospital gown. There was a drip in his right arm, and a catheter in his urethra. He glanced up to see an interface helmet, a bulky hemisphere of magnetic axon current inducers, suspended from a gantry not far above his head. He thought, fair enough, to construct a simulated meeting place that looked like the room that her real body must be in. Putting him in the couch, though, and giving him all the symptoms of a waking visitor seemed a little extreme. He tapped the couch with his left hand. What's the message? You want me to know exactly what you're going through? Okay, I'm grateful, and it's good to see you. He shuddered with relief and delayed shock. Fantastic, to tell the truth. He laughed weakly. I honestly thought he was going to wipe me out. The man's a complete lunatic. Believe me, you're talking to his better half. Elizabeth was perched on a stool beside him. She said,
Paul, try to listen carefully to what I'm going to say. You'll start to reintegrate the memories gradually on your own, but it'll help if I talk you through it all first. To start with, you're not a copy. You're flesh and blood.
Paul coughed, tasting acid. Durham had let her do something unspeakable to the model of his digestive system. I'm flesh and blood. What kind of sadistic joke is that? Do you have any idea how hard it's been coming to terms with the truth? She said patiently,
It's not a joke. I know you don't remember yet, but after you made the scan that was going to run as copy number 5, you finally told me what you were doing, and I persuaded you not to run it until you tried another experiment, putting yourself in its place, finding out firsthand what it would be forced to go through. And you agreed. You entered the virtual environment which the copy would have inhabited, with your memory since the day of the scan suppressed, so you had no way of knowing that you were only a visitor. You're not the copy. Do you understand? All you've been doing is visiting the environment you'd prepared for copy number 5, and now you're out of it. You're back in the real world.
Her face betrayed no hint of deception, but software could smooth that out. He said, I don't believe you. How can I be the original? I spoke to the original. What am I supposed to believe? He was the copy? Thinking he was the original?
Of course not. That would hardly have spared the copy, would it? The 5th scan was never run. I controlled the puppet that played your original. Software provided the vocabulary signature and body language, but I pulled the strings. You briefed me, beforehand, on what to have it say and do. You'll remember that soon enough.
But the experiments...
The experiments were a sham. They could hardly have been performed on a visitor, on a physical brain, could they?
Paul shook his head and whispered, Abulafia. No interface window appeared. He gripped the couch and closed his eyes, then laughed. You say I agreed to this? What kind of masochist would do that? I'm going out of my mind. I don't know what I am. Elizabeth took hold of his arm again.
You're disoriented, but that won't last long, and you know why you agreed. You were sick of copies bailing out on you. You had to come to terms with their experience. Spending a few days believing you were a copy would make or break the project. You'd either end up psychologically prepared, at last, to give rise to a copy who'd be able to cope with its fate, or you'd gain enough sympathy for their plight to stop creating them. The plan was to tell you everything while you were still inside, after the 3rd experiment. But when you went weird on me in there, I panicked. All I could think of was having the puppet playing your original tell you that it was going to pause you. I wasn't trying to frighten you. I didn't think you'd take it so badly.
A technician came into the room and removed the drip and catheter. Paul propped himself up and looked out through the windows of the room's swing doors. He could see half a dozen people in the corridor. He bellowed wordlessly at the top of his lungs. They all turned to stare in his direction. The technician said mildly,
Your penis might sting for an hour or two.
Paul slumped back onto the couch and turned to Elizabeth. You wouldn't pay for reactive crowds. I wouldn't pay for reactive crowds. It looks like you're telling the truth. People, glorious people, thousands of strangers meeting his eyes with suspicion or puzzlement, stepping out of his way on the street, or more often, clearly consciously refusing to. The freedom of the city was so sweet. He walked the streets of Sydney for a full day, rediscovering every ugly shopping arcade, every piss-stinking litter-strewn park and alley, until with aching feet, he squeezed his way home through the evening rush hour to watch the real-time news. There was no room for doubt. He was not in a virtual environment. Nobody in the world could have reason to spend so much money simply to deceive him. When Elizabeth asked if his memories were back, he nodded and said, of course. She didn't grill him on the details. In fact, having gone over her story so many times in his head, he could almost imagine the stages. His qualms after the fifth scan, repeatedly putting off running the model, confessing to Elizabeth about the project, accepting her challenge to experience for himself just what his copies were suffering. And if the suppressed memories hadn't actually reintegrated, well, he'd check the literature, and there was a 2.5% risk of that happening. Electronically censoring access to memories could sometimes permanently weaken the neural connections in which they were encoded. He even had an account from the database service which showed that he'd consulted the very same articles before. He reread and replayed the news reports that he'd accessed from inside and found no discrepancies. He flicked through encyclopedic databases, spot-checking random facts of history, geography, astronomy, and although he was surprised now and then by details which he'd never come across before, there were no startling contradictions. The continents hadn't moved, stars and planets hadn't vanished, the same wars had been lost and won. Everything was consistent, everything was explicable. And yet he couldn't stop wondering about the fate of a copy who was shut down and never run again. A normal human death was one thing, woven into a much vaster tapestry. It was a process which made perfect sense. From the internal point of view of a copy whose model was simply halted, though, there was no explanation whatsoever for its demise, just an edge where the pattern abruptly came to an end. But if the insight he'd gained from the experiments was true, whether or not they'd ever really happened, if a copy could assemble itself from dust scattered across the world and bridge the gaps in its existence with dust from across the universe, then why should it ever come to an inconsistent end? Why shouldn't the pattern keep on finding itself? Or find a larger pattern into which it could merge? The dust theory implied a countless number of alternative worlds, billions of different possible histories spelt out from the same primordial alphabet soup. One history in which Durham did run copy number 5, and one in which he didn't, but was persuaded to take its place as a visitor instead. But if the visitor had been perfectly deceived, and had experienced everything the copy did, what set the two of them apart? So long as the flesh and blood man had no way of knowing the truth, it was meaningless to talk about two different people in two different worlds. The two patterns of thoughts and perceptions had effectively merged into one. If the copy had been allowed to keep on running after the visitor had learnt that he was flesh and blood, their two paths would have diverged again. But the copy had been shut down. It had no future at all in its original world, no separate life to live. So the two subjective histories remained as one. Paul had been a visitor believing he was a copy, and he'd also been the copy itself. The patterns had merged seamlessly. There could be no way of saying that one history was true and the other false. Both explanations were equally valid. Once preparing to be scanned, he'd had two futures. Now, he had two pasts. Paul woke in darkness, confused for a moment, then pulled his cramped left arm out from under the pillow and glanced at his watch. Low-power infrared sensors in the watch face detected his gaze and flashed up at the time, followed by a reminder, due at Landau, 7 a.m. It was barely after 5, but it hardly seemed worth going back to sleep. Memories of the night before came back to him. Elizabeth had finally confronted him, asking what decision he'd reached, to abandon his life's work or to forge ahead now that he knew firsthand what was involved. His answer seemed to have disappointed her. He didn't expect to see her again. How could he give up?
He knew he could never be sure that he discovered the truth, but that didn't mean that nobody else could. If he made a copy, ran it for a few virtual days, then terminated it abruptly, then at least that copy would know if its own pattern of experience continued. And if another Paul Durham in one of the countless billions of alternative worlds could provide a future for the terminated copy, a pattern into which it could merge, then perhaps that flesh-and-blood Durham would repeat the whole process again, and so on, again and again. And although the seams would always be perfect, the explanation for the flesh-and-blood human believing that he had a second past as a copy would necessarily grow ever more contrived, less convincing, and the dust theory would become ever more compelling. Paul lay in bed in the darkness, waiting for sunrise, staring into the future down this corridor of mirrors. One thing nagged at him. He could have sworn he'd had a dream just before he woke. An elaborate fable, conveying some kind of insight. That's all he knew, or thought he knew. The details hovered maddeningly on the verge of recollection. His dreams were evanescent, though, and he didn't expect to remember anything more.
Chapter 17. Remit, Not Paucity. April 2051.
Maria shifted in her seat to try to get her circulation flowing, then realized it wasn't enough. She stood up and limped around the room, bending down to massage her cramped right calf. She said, "And you claim you're the 23rd. She was almost afraid to sound too skeptical. Not because she believed that Durham would take offense, but because the story was so strangely entrancing that she wasn't sure she wanted to deflate it, yet. One hint of mockery and the floodgates would open. "You're the 23rd flesh and blood Paul Durham, whose past includes all those who came before." Durham said, "I may be wrong about the exact number. I may have counted this last version more than once. If I'm capable of believing in 23 incarnations, some of them might be false. The whole nature of the delusions I suffered contributes to the uncertainty." "Contributes? Isn't that a bit of an understatement?" Durham was unflappable. "I'm cured now. The nanosurgery worked. The doctors pronounced me sane, and I have no reason to question their judgment. They've scanned my brain. It's functioning impeccably. I've seen the data, before and after. Activity in the prefrontal cortex."
"But don't you see how absurd that is? You acknowledge that you were deluded. You insist that you're cured now, but you claim that your delusions weren't delusions."
Durham said patiently, "I've admitted from the outset. My condition explains everything. I believed, because I was mentally ill, that I was the 23rd generation copy of another Paul Durham from another world."
"Because you were mentally ill. End of story."
"No, because I'm certifiably rational now, and the logic of the dust theory makes as much sense to me as ever, and it makes no difference whether my memories are true, false, or both."
Maria groaned.
"Logic of the dust theory. It's not a theory. It can't be tested."
"Can't be tested by whom?"
"By anyone. I mean, even assuming that everything you believe is the truth, you've been through 23 separate experiments, and you still don't know what you've proved or disproved. As you say, your condition accounts for everything. Haven't you heard of Occam's razor? Once you have a perfectly simple explanation for something, you don't go looking for ever more complicated ways of explaining the very same thing? No dust theory is required."
Her words reverberated in the near-empty room. She said,
"I need some fresh air."
Durham said firmly, "After 23 ambiguous results, I know how to get it right this time. A copy plus a virtual environment is a patchwork, a mess. A system like that isn't rich enough, detailed enough, or consistent enough to be self-sustaining. If it was, when I was shut down, the entire VR world I was in would have persisted. That never happened. Instead, every time I found a flesh and blood human with a reason to believe he shared my past. That explained my pattern of experience far better than VR, even to the point of insanity. What I have to do now is construct a consistent pattern which can only have one past.
Maria took a few deep breaths. It was almost too much to bear. Durham sat flat, his cosmic visions, his relentless, mechanical logic, grinding away trying to make sense of the legacy of his disease. The doctors had cured him. He was sane. He just didn't want to disown his delusional past, so he'd invented a flawlessly logical, utterly irrefutable reason to hang on to it. If he'd really told the cops all this, why were they still hounding him? They should have seen that he was harmless and left him alone, and left his moronic clients to fend for themselves. The man wasn't even a danger to himself. And if he could ever harness a fraction of the energy and intelligence he'd put into this project and direct it toward something worthwhile. Durham said, "Do you know what a Garden of Eden configuration is?" Maria was caught blank for a second. Then she said, "Yes, of course. In cellular automaton theory, it's a state of the system that can't be the result of any previous state. No other pattern of cells can give rise to it. If you want a Garden of Eden configuration, you have to start with it. You have to put it in by hand as the system's first state." Durham grinned at her as if she just conceded the whole argument. She said, "What? Isn't it obvious? A cellular automaton isn't like patchwork VR. It's every bit as consistent as a physical universe. There's no jumble of ad hoc high-level laws. One set of rules applies to every cell, right?"
"Yes, but..."
"So, if I set up a cellular automaton in a Garden of Eden configuration, run it through a few trillion clock ticks, then shut it down, the pattern will continue to find itself in the dust, separate from this version of me, separate from this world, but still flowing unambiguously from that initial state. A state which can't be explained by the rules of the automaton. A state which must have been constructed in another world, exactly as I remember it. The whole problem so far has been that my memories are always entirely explicable within the new world. I shut myself down as a copy and find myself in a flesh and blood body with flesh and blood memories which the laws of physics could have produced from earlier states of a flesh and blood brain. This world can explain me, only as man whose delusions are unlikely beyond belief, but there's no denying that I do have a complete extra history here. That's not literally, physically impossible. So whatever I prefer to believe, I have to concede that the outcome of the experiment is still ambiguous. I could still be wrong. But a cellular automaton can't provide an extra history for a Garden of Eden configuration. It's mathematically impossible. If I find myself inside a cellular automaton universe, and I can track my past back to a Garden of Eden configuration, that will be conclusive proof that I did seed the whole universe in a previous incarnation. The dust theory will be vindicated, and I'll finally know, beyond any doubt, that I haven't merely been insane all along. Maria felt punch drunk. At one level, she knew she should stop humoring him. Stop treating his ideas seriously. On another, it seemed that if Durham was so wrong, she should be able to point out the reasons why. She shouldn't have to call him a madman and refuse to listen to another word. She said, "Find yourself in a cellular automaton world. You don't mean the autoverse?" "Of course not. There's no prospect of translating a human into autoverse biochemistry."
"Then what?"
"There's a cellular automaton called TVC, after Turing, von Neumann, and Chang. Chang completed it around 2010. It's a souped-up, more elegant version of von Neumann's work from the 1950s. Maria nodded uncertainly. She'd heard of all this, but it wasn't her field. She did know that John von Neumann and his students had developed a two-dimensional cellular automaton, a simple universe in which you could embed an elaborate pattern of cells, a rather Lego-like machine, which acted as both a universal constructor and a universal computer. Given the right program, a string of cells to be interpreted as coded instructions rather than part of the machine, it could carry out any computation and build anything at all, including another copy of itself, which could build another copy, and so on. Little self-replicating toy computers could blossom into existence without end. She said,
Chang's version was three-dimensional, wasn't it?
Much better. N-dimensional. 4, 5, 6, whatever you like. That leaves plenty of room for data within easy reach. In two dimensions, the original von Neumann machine had to reach further and further and wait longer and longer for each successive bit of data. In a six-dimensional TVC automaton, you can have a three-dimensional grid of computers which keeps on growing indefinitely, each with its own three-dimensional memory which can also grow without bound. Maria said numbly,
Where are you supposed to fit into all of this? If you think translating human biochemistry into autoverse terms is difficult, how are you going to map yourself into a six-dimensional world designed solely to support von Neumann machines?
The TVC universe is one big, ever-expanding processor cluster. It runs a copy of me.
I thought the whole point was to do away with copies.
In a VR environment, which lets me interact with the TVC level. Yes, I'll be a patchwork copy, as always. There's no alternative to that. But I'll also be linked to the cellular automaton itself. I'll witness its operation. I'll experience its laws. By observing it, I'll make it a part of what has to be explained. And when the simulated TVC universe being run on the physical computer is suddenly shut down, the best explanation for what I've witnessed will be a continuation of that universe, an extension made out of dust. Maria could almost see it. A vast lattice of computers, a seed of order in a sea of a random noise, extending itself from moment to moment by sheer force of internal logic, accreting the necessary building blocks from the chaos of non-space-time by the very act of defining space and time. Visualizing wasn't believing, though. She said,
What makes you so sure? Why not another deluded psychiatric patient who believes he was, briefly, a copy being run on a TVC automaton being run on a processor cluster in another world?
You're the one who invoked Occam's razor. Wouldn't you say that a self-contained TVC universe is a simpler explanation by far?
No, it's about the most bizarre thing I can imagine.
It's a lot less bizarre than yet another version of this universe, containing yet another version of me with yet another set of convenient illusions.
How many of your clients believed all this? How many think they're coming along for the ride?
15. And there's a 16th who, I think, is tempted.
They paid?
About $2 million each, he snorted. It's quite funny, the significance the police have attached to that. Some large sums of money have changed hands for reasons more complex than usual, so they assume I must be doing something illegal. I mean, billionaires have been known to make donations larger than that to the Church of the God who makes no difference. He added hastily, None of mine. Maria was having some trouble with the scale of things herself.
You found 15 copies willing to part with $2 million after hearing this bullshit. Anyone that gullible deserves to lose their money.
Durham took no offense. If you were a copy, you'd believe the dust theory too. You'd feel the truth of it in your non-existent bones. Some of these people carried out the same experiments as I did, computing themselves in randomized fragments, but others didn't need to. They already knew that they could scatter themselves across real time and real space, and they'd still find themselves. Every copy proves the dust theory to itself 1,000,000 times a day. It suddenly occurred to Maria that Durham might have invented all of this for her sake alone, while telling his clients exactly what Hayden had assumed. Some fraudulent but utterly non-metaphysical tale of a hidden supercomputer. But she couldn't see what he had to gain by confusing her, and too many details made too much sense now. If his clients had accepted the whole mad vision, the problem of making them believe in a non-existent supercomputer vanished. Or at least, changed from a question of evidence to a question of faith. She said, "So you promised to fit a snapshot of each of your backers into the Garden of Eden configuration, plus the software to run them on the TVC?" Durham said proudly, "All that and more. The major world libraries, not quite the full holdings, but tens of millions of files, text, audio, visual, interactive, on every conceivable subject. Databases too numerous to list, including all the map genomes. Software, expert systems, knowledge miners, metaprogrammers, thousands of off-the-shelf VR environments, deserts, jungles, coral reefs, Mars and the Moon, and I've commissioned Malcolm Carter, no less, to create a major city to act as a central meeting place. Permutation City, capital of the TVC universe. And of course, there'll be your contribution, the seed for an alien world. Humanity is going to find other life in this universe eventually. How can we give up hope of doing the same? Sure, we'll have our own software descendants and recreated Earth animals and no doubt novel, wholly artificial creatures as well. We won't be alone, but we still need a chance to confront the other. We mustn't leave that possibility behind. And what could be more alien than autoverse life? Maria's skin crawled. Durham's logic was impeccable. An endlessly expanding TVC universe with new computing power being manufactured out of nothing in all directions would eventually be big enough to run an autoverse planet, or even a whole planetary system. The packed version of Planet Lambert, the compressed description, with its topographic summaries in place of actual mountains and rivers, would easily fit into the memory of a real-world computer. Then Durham's copy could simply wait for the TVC grid to be big enough, or pause himself to avoid waiting and have the whole thing unfold. Durham said, "I've been working on the software which will run the first moments of the TVC universe on a real-world computer. I can probably finish that myself, but I can't complete the Autoverse work without you, Maria." She laughed sharply. "You want me to keep working for you? You lie to me, you get me visited by the fraud squad, you confess to a history of mental illness, you tell me you're the 23rd incarnation of a retailing millionaire from a parallel world. Whatever you think about the dust theory, and whatever you think about my psychological health, I can prove to you that I'm not a criminal. My backers will vouch for that. They all know exactly what their money's being used for. None of them are victims of fraud."
"I accept that. I just..."
"Then accept the payment. Finish the work. Whatever the police have told you, you have every right to the money, and I have every right to give it to you. Nobody's going to take you to court. Nobody's going to throw you into prison." Maria was flustered.
"Just hold on. Will you give me a chance to think?"
Durham's sheer reasonableness was beginning to be as exhausting as the impassioned rhetoric of any obvious fanatic, and so much ground had shifted in the last half hour that she hadn't had a chance to even start to reappraise her own situation, legally, financially, and morally. She said,
"Why don't your backers tell the police all this? If they can confirm your story for me, why can't they do the same for the cops? By refusing to talk, they're just fueling suspicion."
Durham agreed. "Tell me about it. It makes everything 10 times harder. But I'm just going to have to keep on living with that." "Do you think they'd risk the truth becoming public knowledge? There have already been some embarrassing leaks, but so far, we've been able to muddy the water by putting out our own misinformation. Copies with de facto control of billion-dollar business empires would much rather have people linking them to some dubious salesman and his breakthrough supercomputer, and have the rumors fizzle out from lack of substantiation, than let the world know that they plan to send a clone into an artificial universe which runs without hardware. The share markets can get nervous enough when people start wondering if a certain board of directors have all taken up playing virtual Caligula in their spare time.
If word got out that a copy in a position of power had done something which might be construed as a sign that they no longer felt obliged to give a shit about their corporate responsibilities, their personal wealth, or the continued existence of planet Earth. Maria walked over to the window. It was open, but the air outside was still. Standing by the insect screen, she might as well have been standing by a solid brick wall. People were arguing loudly in the flat above. She'd only just noticed. When Durham had first approached her, she'd wondered half-seriously if she'd be taking advantage of a man who'd taken leave of his senses. Now she couldn't just shrug that off as a hypocritical insult to a fellow eccentric. This wasn't a matter of an artificial life fanatic with more money than sense. An ex-psychiatric patient was planning to spend $30 million of other people's money to prove his own sanity and lead the clones of his followers into a cybernetic paradise, which would last for about 20 seconds. Taking a cut seemed just a tiny bit like doing the catering for the Jonestown Massacre. Durham said, "If you don't agree to finish the biosphere seed, who would I get to replace you? There's nobody else who could even begin to grasp what's involved." Maria eyed him sharply.
"Don't start flattering me, and don't kid yourself about the seed either. You asked for a package of persuasive data, and that's all you'll be getting, even if I finish the work. If you're counting on Planet Lambert's inhabitants rising up on their hind legs and talking to you, I can't guarantee that happening if you ran the whole thing a billion times. You should have simulated real-world biochemistry. At least it's been shown that intelligent life can arise within that system, and you'd supposedly have the computing power to do it."
Durham said reasonably, "A. Lamberti seems simpler, sure. Any real-world organism, modeled subatomically, would be too big a program to test out in advance on any physical computer. And it'd be too late to change my mind and try another approach if I failed to get it to work, stuck in the TVC universe with plenty of books and journals, but no pool of expertise." Maria felt a deep chill pass through her. Every time she thought she'd accepted just how seriously Durham took this lunacy, he gave an answer like that which drove it home to her anew. She said,
"Well, Autoverse life might turn out just as useless. You might have A. Hydrophila spewing out useless mutations, generation after generation, with nothing you can do to fix it."
Durham seemed about to reply, but then stopped himself. Maria felt the chill return, at first without knowing why. A second later, she glared at him, outraged, as furious as if he'd come right out and asked her.
"I will not be there to fix it for you."
Durham had the grace to look cowed, momentarily, but instead of denying that the thought had ever crossed his mind, he said, "If you don't believe in the dust theory, what difference would it make if there's a scan file of you in the Garden of Eden data?"
"I don't want a copy of me waking up and living for a few subjective seconds, knowing that it's going to die."
"Who said anything about waking it? Running a copy on a simulated TVC grid is a computer-intensive operation. We can't afford to wake more than one copy while we're still running on a physical computer. Mine. As far as you're concerned, your scan file would never even be used to build a copy. The data would just sit there, completely inert, and you could sit outside at a terminal, overseeing the whole operation, making sure I kept my word." Maria was scandalized, although it took her a second to weave through Durham's infuriating logic to find a target.
"And you, certain that I'd eventually wake, would happily take me on board under false pretenses?"
Durham seemed genuinely baffled by the accusation. "False pretenses? I've given you all the facts, and I've argued my case as hard as I can. It's not my fault if you don't believe me. Am I supposed to feel guilty for being right?" Maria started to reply, but then the point seemed too ridiculous to pursue. She said,
"Never mind. You won't get a chance to feel anything about it, because I'm certainly not offering you a scan file."
Durham bowed his head. "It's your decision." Maria hugged herself. She was actually trembling slightly. She thought, I'm afraid of exploiting him? If what he's doing really is legitimate, finish the job, take the money. His copy's going to spend a few seconds believing it's headed for copy heaven, and that's going to happen whatever I do. The 15 clones will just sleep through it all, as if they'd never been made. That's no Jonestown. Durham said, The fee would be $600,000. Maria said, I don't care if it's 600 million. She'd meant to shout, but her words faded out into a whisper. $600,000 would be enough to save Francesca's life.
Chapter 18. Remit, not paucity. May 2051. Pierce seemed to be making love with Kate, but he had his doubts. He lay on the soft, dry grass of a boundless meadow in mild sunshine. Kate's hair was longer than usual, tickling his skin wherever she kissed him, brushing against him with an erotic precision which seemed unlikely to have been left to chance. Insect chirps and birdsong were heard. Pierre could recall David Hawthorne screwing a long-suffering lover in a field once. They'd been driving back to London from her father's funeral in Yorkshire. It had seemed like a good idea at the time. This was different. No twigs, no stones, no animal shit, no damp earth, no grass stains, no itching. The perfect meadow itself was no reason for suspicion. Neither of them were verisimilitude freaks, masochistic recreators of the irritating details of real environments. Good sex was equally a matter of choice. But Pierre still found himself wondering if Kate really had agreed to the act. She hadn't actually made love to him for months, however many times he'd recycled the memories of the last occasion. And he couldn't rule out the possibility that he'd merely decided to fool himself into believing that she'd finally relented. He'd never gone quite so far before, so far as he presently knew, but he had a vague memory of resolving to do a thorough job of concealing the evidence, if he ever did. He could clearly remember Kate beginning to flirt as they'd toured Carter City, and then reaching out and starting to undress him as they stood in the exit doorway. He'd shut down all limits on her access to his body while she'd been unbuttoning his shirt, and he'd bellowed with shock and delight when in the middle of their physically plausible foreplay, an invisible second Kate, 20 times his size, had picked him up in one hand, raised him to her mouth, and licked his body from toes to forehead, like a sweet-toothed giant taking the icing off a man-shaped cake. None of this struck him as especially unlikely. If Kate had decided to make love again, it was the kind of thing he could imagine her doing. That in itself proved nothing. He could have scripted this fantasy to fit everything he knew about her, or chosen the scenario, and then rewritten his knowledge of her to accommodate the action. In either case, software could have laid down a trail of false memories. A plausible transition from their meeting with Carter, which he felt certain had actually happened, to this moment. All memories of having planned the deception would have been temporarily suppressed. Kate stopped moving. She shook her head, spattering his face and chest with sweat, and said,
Are you here, where you seem to be, or off somewhere else?
I was about to ask you the same question.
She smiled wickedly.
Ah, then maybe this body you hope is me only asked you first to put your mind at ease.
In the sky above her right shoulder, Pierre could see a stray cloud taking on a new shape, a whimsical sculpture parodying the bodies on the grass below.
He said, And then admitted as much?
Kate nodded and started slowly rising.
Of course, for the very same reason. How many levels of bluffing will it take before you get bored and say, Fuck it, I don't care?
She lifted herself until they were almost apart. He closed his eyes and violated the geometry, licking the sweat from between her shoulder blades without moving a muscle. She responded by sticking her tongue in both of his ears simultaneously. He laughed and opened his eyes. The cloud above had darkened. Kate lowered herself onto him again, trembling very slightly. She said,
"Don't you find it ironic?"
"What?"
"Transhumans taking pleasure by stimulating copies of the neural pathways which used to be responsible for the continuation of the species. Out of all the possibilities, we cling to that."
Pierce said, "No, I don't find it ironic. I had my irony glands removed. It was either that or castration." She smiled down at him.
"I love you, you know. But would I tell you that, or would you be stupid enough to pretend that I had?"
Warm, sweet rain began to fall. He said, "I don't care. I don't care. I don't care." Pierre sat on the lowest of the four wooden steps leading up to the back porch of his homestead, glancing down now and then at his bare feet and thin brown arms. 10-year-old farm boy at dusk. Kate had made both the environment and the body for him, and he liked the tranquil mood of the piece. There was no invented family, no role to play. This was a painting, not a drama. One place, one moment, lasting as long as he chose to inhabit it. The scenery wasn't quite photorealist. There were subtle distortions of form, color, and texture, which made it impossible to forget that he was inhabiting a work of art. But there were no sledgehammer techniques, no visible brushstrokes, no Van Gogh lighting effects. Violating the whole aesthetic, an interface window hovered in front of him, a meter above the chicken feed scattered dirt. The cloning utility insisted on following an elaborate confirmation sequence. Pierre kept saying, "Please skip to the final question. I know exactly what I'm doing." But icons in legal wigs and gowns kept popping up in front of the window and declaring solemnly, "You must read this warning carefully. Your brain model will be directly examined for evidence of complete understanding before we proceed to the next stage." It was 1,000 times more trouble than bailing out. He knew that for certain, having almost done it. But then bailing out entailed fewer legal complications for the people outside. Pierre's estate was controlled by an executor, who'd signed a contract obliging her to act according to any duly authenticated communications, including, but not limited to, visual and/or auditory simulations of a human being appearing to proffer instructions or advice. What duly authenticated meant revolved around a 99-digit code key which had been hardwired into Pierre's model of a brain when his copy was generated from his scan file. He could summon it up consciously if he had to, in some unlikely emergency, but normally he made use of it by a simple act of will. He'd record a video postcard, wish it to be duly authenticated, and it was done. Unless the key was stolen, plucked right out of the computer memory, which contained the data representing his brain. Pierre was the only software on the planet capable of encrypting instructions to his executor in a form compatible with her own matching key. It was the closest thing he had to a legal identity. By law, any clone which a copy made of itself had to be given a new key. It was up to the initial copy, prior to the cloning, to divide up the worldly assets between the two future selves, or rather, divide them up between the executor's two portfolios. Pierre fought his way through the process of assuring the cloning utility that he really had meant what he told it from the start. The clone would require no assets of its own. Pierre would run it on sufferance, paying for its running time himself. He didn't plan on keeping it conscious for more than a minute or two, just long enough to reassure himself that he was doing the right thing. He almost wished that Kate was with him now. She'd offered to be here, but he turned her down. He would have been glad of her support, but this had to be done in private. Finally, the utility said, "This is your last chance to cancel.
Are you sure you wish to proceed?
Pierre closed his eyes. When I see my original sitting on the porch, I'll know who I am and accept it. He said,
Yes, I'm sure.
Pierre felt no change. He opened his eyes. His newly made twin stood on the ground where the interface window had been, staring at him, wide-eyed. Pierre shivered. He recognized the boy as himself, and not just intellectually. Kate's piece included adjustments to every part of his brain, which dealt with his body image, so he'd be no more shocked by catching a glimpse of himself in a mirror than he was by the way his limbs felt as he walked. But the effect wasn't so much to see through the disguise of the 10-year-old body, as to find himself thinking of the clone, and himself, as if the two of them really were that young. How could he send this child into exile? Pierre brushed the absurd notion aside. Well? The clone seemed dazed. Pierre prompted him.
You know what I want to hear. Are you ready for this? Are you happy with your fate? Did I make the right decision? You're the one who knows now.
But I don't know.
He looked at Pierre pleadingly, as if hoping for guidance.
Why am I doing this? Remind me.
Pierre was taken aback, but some disorientation was only to be expected. His own voice sounded normal to him, thanks to the neural adjustments, but the clone still sounded like a frightened child. He said gently,
Kate, we want to be with her. Both of her.
The clone nodded fervently.
Of course.
He laughed nervously.
And of course I'm ready. Everything's fine.
His eyes darted around the yard as if he was searching for an escape route. Pierre felt his chest tighten. He said evenly,
You don't have to go ahead if you don't want to. You know that. You can bail out right now, if that's what you'd prefer.
The clone looked more alarmed than ever.
I don't want that. I want to stow away with Kate.
He hesitated, then added,
She'll be happier in there, more secure, and I do want to be with her, and I want to know that side of her.
Then what's wrong?
The clone sank to his knees in the dirt. For a second, Pierre thought he was sobbing. Then he realized that the noise was laughter. The clone recovered his composure and said,
Nothing's wrong. But how do you expect me to take it? The two of us, cut off from everything else, not just the real world, but all the other copies.
Pierce said,
If you get lonely, you can always generate new people. You'll have access to ontogenesis software, and no reason to care about the slowdown.
The clone started laughing again. Tears streamed down his face. Hugging himself, he tumbled sideways onto the ground. Pierre looked on, bemused. The clone said,
Here I am trying to steel myself for the wedding, and already you're threatening me with children.
Suddenly he reached out and grabbed Pierre by one ankle, then dragged him off the step. Pierre hit the ground on his arse with a jarring thud. His first instinct was to freeze the clone's power to interact with him, but he stopped himself. He was in no danger. And if his twin wanted to burn off some aggression on his brother creator, he could take it. They were evenly matched, after all. 2 minutes later, Pierre was lying with his face in the dirt and his arms pinned behind his back. The clone kneeled over him, breathless but triumphant. Pierre said,
All right, you win. Now get off me, or I'll double my height, put on 40 kilograms, and get up and flatten you.
The clone said,
Do you know what we should do?
Shake hands and say goodbye.
Toss a coin.
For what?
The clone laughed.
What do you think?
You said you were happy to go.
I am, but so should you be. I say we toss a coin. If I win, we swap key numbers.
That's illegal.
Illegal?
The clone was contemptuous.
Listen to the Solipsist Nation copy, invoke the laws of the world. It's easily done. The software exists. All you have to do is agree.
Talking was difficult. Pierre spat out sand, but there was a seed of some kind caught between his teeth, which he couldn't dislodge. He felt a curious reluctance to cheat, though, to remove the seed from his mouth or the clone from his back. It had been so long since he'd been forced to endure the slightest discomfort that the novelty seemed to outweigh the inconvenience. He said, "All right, I'll do it." And if he lost? But why should he fear that? 5 minutes ago, he'd been prepared to give rise to become the clone who'd stow away. They created the coin together, the only way to ensure that it was subject to no hidden influences. The reality editor they jointly invoked offered a standard object ready-made for their purpose, which they decorated as a 1-pound coin. The physics of flipping a real coin wouldn't come into it. Any copy could easily calculate and execute a flick of the thumb, leading to a predetermined outcome. The result would be controlled by a random number generator deep in the hidden layers of the operating system. Pierre said, "I toss, you call." At exactly the same time as the clone. He laughed. The clone smiled faintly. Pierre was about to defer, then decided to wait. A few seconds later he said alone, "All right, you toss." As the coin went up, Pierre thought about encasing it in a second object, an invisibly thin shell under his control alone. But the long list of attributes of the fair coin probably included crying foul if its true faces were concealed. He shouted, "Heads!" just before the thing hit the dirt. The two of them fell to their hands and knees, almost bumping heads. A hen approached. Pierre shooted away with a backwards kick. President Kinnock, in profile, glinted in the dust. The clone met his eyes. Pierre did his best not to look relieved, short of severing ties with his body. He tried to read the clone's expression and failed. All he saw was a reflection of his own growing numbness. Pirandello had said it was impossible to feel any real emotion while staring into a mirror. Pierre decided to take that as a good sign. They were still one person after all, and that was the whole point. The clone rose to his feet, dusting off his knees and elbows. Pierre took a hologram-embossed library card from the back pocket of his jeans and handed it over. It was an icon for a copy of all the environments, customized utilities, bodies, memories, and other data he'd accumulated since his resurrection. The clone said,
"Don't worry about me or Kate. We'll look after each other. We'll be happy."
As he spoke, he morphed smoothly into an older body. Pierce said, "Ditto." He reached up and shook the young man's hand. Then he summoned one of his control windows and froze the clone, leaving the motionless body visible as an icon for the snapshot file. He shrunk it to a height of a few centimeters, flattened it into a 2-dimensional postcard, and wrote on the back, "To Malcolm Carter." Then he walked down the road a kilometer to one of Kate's little touches, a postbox marked U.S. Mail, and dropped the postcard in.
Chapter 19. Remit Not Paucity. June 2051. The anesthetist said, "Count backwards from 10. Maria said, 10. She dreamt of arriving on Francesca's doorstep with a suitcase full of money. As she walked down the hall behind her mother, the case fell open, and $100 bills fluttered out and filled the air like confetti. Francesca turned to her, radiant with health. She said tenderly,
"You shouldn't have, my darling, but I understand. You can't take it with you."
Maria laughed.
"You can't take you with you."
Her father was in the living room, dressed for his wedding day, although not as young. He beamed and held out his arms to Maria. His parents and Francesca's parents stood behind him, and as Maria approached, she saw from on high that behind her grandparents were cousins and aunts, great-grandparents and great-aunts, row after row of relatives and ancestors
stretching back into the depths of the house, laughing and chattering. The money had brought them all back to life. How could she have been so selfish as to think